Welcome back to the Deep Dive, everybody. Today we're diving into a topic that I think is going to be pretty important for all of you future lawyers out there. Anticipatory repudiation. Yeah, it's all about what happens when, well, you know, you're in a contract and one of the sides says basically, "Hey, I'm not going to do this." And they say it before they're actually, you know, supposed to do the thing.
Yeah, it's a really interesting concept. You know, it kind of gets to the heart of contract law in a very practical way.
Yeah, and it's definitely something you're going to need to know whether you're, you know, actually drafting contracts or you know, litigating over them.
Absolutely. And, you know, it has big implications, you know, for both sides of a contract. You know, the party that's saying, "I'm not going to do it," they're facing potential legal action. But, you know, the other party, the one that's, you know, been kind of left hanging, you know, they also need to know what their rights are, what they can do.
Right, right, exactly. So to really get into the nitty gritty of anticipatory repudiation, we're going to look at a specific case. It's Ratliff versus Hardison, a 2008 case out of Arizona. And it really, like, perfectly shows how this whole doctrine can play out in a real world scenario.
Yeah, it's a great case to learn from because it's, you know, it's not too complicated, but it touches on all the key elements of anticipatory repudiation.
So for our listeners, you know, Ratliff versus Hardison, it boils down to a farmland sale that, well, let's just say it didn't exactly go as planned. There was this pretty big earnest money deposit involved, and that became like the big point of contention when the whole thing went south. So our main goal today is to really figure out, okay, did the actions of this guy, Mr. Hardison, did they actually meet the legal definition of anticipatory repudiation? You know, did he really cross that line? And then just as important, could he, like, you know, walk back from that cliff? Could he kind of undo his statement and say, "Wait, no, actually, I'm going to fulfill my end of the bargain after all." So it's kind of like, okay, when can you bail on a deal early? And then what do you have to do if you want to, like, change your mind?
That's a really good way to frame it. So to understand what happened, we need to go back to the beginning. It all starts in January of 2006. Mr. Hardison, he agrees to buy this huge farm from Mr. Ratliff. We're talking 1,020 acres of land in Arizona with a price tag of $3.5 million. You know, not a small deal at all.
Yeah, not your everyday purchase, that's for sure. Huge property, a ton of money. And they set a closing date of August 1st, 2006. So far, so good, right?
Seems pretty straightforward. And to show he's serious, Hardison puts down a $100,000 earnest money deposit.
Wow, $100,000.
Yeah.
That's serious money.
Yeah.
Shows you how much he wanted this land, at least at first, right?
But then things start to get a little rocky. A few months into the deal, somewhere around February or March, Hardison learns about this Arizona law. It's Arizona Revised Statute 33422.
Uh-oh, legal jargon alert.
Yeah, it's basically a statute that requires sellers of land in certain situations to give the buyer a disclosure affidavit about the property. You know, it lays out certain things about the property, things that the buyer should know, and this affidavit has to be given at least 7 days before the, you know, the sale goes final.
So Hardison finds out about this law and what he thinks it applies to this farm sale, right?
Yeah, he believed that Ratliff should have provided him with this affidavit. But here's the thing, he doesn't immediately bring it up with Ratliff.
Interesting. So it seems like this concern about the affidavit was kind of simmering in the back of his mind for a while. He didn't say anything right away, though. Why not? Do we know?
It's not entirely clear why he waited, but the fact that he didn't address it immediately is going to become relevant later on when we get to the legal analysis. But, you know, the first real sign of trouble, the thing that really kicks off this whole anticipatory repudiation situation, it doesn't actually come until July.
Okay, so we're getting close to that August 1st closing date. What happens?
Well, on July 22nd, so just a little over a week before they're supposed to close, Hardison leaves a voicemail for Ratliff. And it wasn't just, "Hey, checking in, looking forward to closing soon." No, he was trying to change the deal. He wanted to either get a lower price for the farm or just buy part of the land, not the whole 1,020 acres.
Oh, wow. So not just a small tweak. He's like renegotiating the whole deal at the 11th hour.
Exactly. And that move, you know, trying to change the fundamental terms of the agreement so close to closing, it was a big red flag. You know, it definitely suggested that he might not have been willing to go through with the purchase as it was originally agreed. But it gets even more direct than that. Hardison actually admitted in his deposition later on what he was thinking toward the end of July. He straight up said that he had decided not to buy the farm. And importantly, he actually told this to Ratliff and to his own banker, too.
No kidding. So he actually, like, flat out told them.
Yeah, he did.
What did he say exactly? Like, how did he phrase it?
Well, the quote from his testimony is pretty telling. He said that he decided the smartest thing he could do was to walk away from the deal. Basically, he was willing to lose that $100,000 deposit just to get out of the contract. He said he just elected to say he wouldn't buy it. And he told Ratliff point blank that he had decided not to purchase the farm.
Wow. I mean, he didn't beat around the bush. That does sound like a pretty clear indication that he wasn't planning on holding up his end of the bargain.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to interpret that any other way. That statement, that explicit declaration that he wasn't going to perform his part of the contract, that's really the heart of the whole anticipatory repudiation argument. So, you know, as you can imagine, the August 1st closing date comes and goes, and no surprise, the sale doesn't happen.
Of course not. What did Ratliff do then? I mean, he's got this contract, Hardison's backed out. What's next?
Well, Ratliff's lawyer got involved. They sent a letter to Hardison demanding that they close the sale by August 9th or else they'd take legal action. So, you know, things are getting serious.
Oh, yeah, definitely raising the stakes. So we've got Hardison, you know, very clearly saying he's done with the deal. But wait, there's more to the story, right? I mean, it doesn't end there.
Right. Things take another turn. On August 9th and then again on August 15th, Hardison calls Ratliff. And in those calls, he says that he does still want to buy the land. Sounds like he's having second thoughts.
Okay, so he's trying to backtrack a little bit, but I'm guessing there's a catch, right? I mean, it wouldn't be a very interesting case otherwise.
You're right. There's a big but here. He was willing to buy the land, but only if Ratliff agreed to renegotiate the terms. Specifically, he wanted a lower price. He was saying that, you know, the market was uncertain, he was having trouble selling another property, and that's why he needed a price reduction. Understandably, Ratliff wasn't keen on giving him a discount.
Of course not. I mean, who would be, right? So it wasn't as simple, I was wrong, I'll go back to the original deal and pay the $3.5 million. It was more like, I'll buy it, but only if you give me a better price. That seems like a really important difference, legally speaking.
Oh, it's absolutely crucial. That distinction is at the heart of the legal arguments in this case. You know, it's the difference between a true retraction and just trying to change the deal after you've already said you're out. Then things get even more intense. On August 25th, Ratliff sends another letter. This time, it's an ultimatum. He says that if the sale doesn't close within 13 days, the contract is off. No more messing around.
So now Hardison's really got to make up his mind. 13 days, ticking clock, what does he do?
Well, right before that 13-day deadline expires, on August 30th, Hardison's lawyer sends a letter to Ratliff. And in this letter, they demand that Ratliff provide that disclosure affidavit, the one we talked about earlier, under that Arizona statute 33-422. So after saying he wasn't buying, then trying to get a lower price, now he's coming back and saying, hey, where's that document you're supposed to give me?
Okay, I'm trying to follow the timeline here. Agreement, Hardison says, nope, I'm out. Then he tries to haggle the price, and now finally he's bringing up this affidavit. So before we get to what the court ultimately decided, let's break down the legal side of things. What does the law actually say about anticipatory repudiation? What's the bar that has to be met?
Good question. In Arizona, and this is what the court in Ratliff v. Hardison focused on, anticipatory repudiation happens when one party very clearly shows, without a doubt, that they won't do what they're supposed to do under the contract. And they have to show this before the time they're actually supposed to do it. The legal term they use is positive and unequivocal manifestation. It's more than just, you know, having some doubts or expressing concerns. It's got to be super clear that you intend to breach the contract. Think of it like, you know, positive and unequivocal. Those words mean there's no way the other side could misunderstand that you're backing out of the deal.
Gotcha. Positive and unequivocal. So, looking back at what Hardison did, those things he said at the end of July, telling Ratliff he wouldn't buy it and that he was fine losing his deposit, I mean, that seems to fit that definition, doesn't it? It wasn't just a negotiating tactic. He was directly saying, I'm not doing this.
Exactly. And the court really zeroed in on that. His own words from his deposition were the key piece of evidence. When he said he decided the smartest thing was to walk away and forfeit the deposit, and that he had elected to say he wouldn't buy it, and then he told Ratliff straight up, I've decided not to buy your farm. Well, those statements are pretty clear. There's not a lot of wiggle room there. He was saying in no uncertain terms that he wasn't going to buy the farm on August 1st, like they had agreed.
Okay, so the court was convinced that he had repudiated the contract back in July. But what about those times when he said he'd still buy it later on in August? Why did that count as taking it back?
That's where the law gets even more specific. To officially retract an anticipatory repudiation, you have to do it just as clearly as the original repudiation. And the commitment to follow through with the contract has to be unconditional. no strings attached. You can't add new conditions or try to change the deal. You have to say, okay, I messed up. I'm going back to the original terms exactly as they were. That's the standard.
And that's where Hardison's attempts to, I guess, get back in the game kind of fell apart.
Right.
Because he always had that condition, that lower price. He never said, okay, never mind, I'll pay the full $3.5 million. It was always, I'll buy it, but only if you give me a discount.
Precisely. Those calls on August 9th and 15th, when he was saying he wanted to buy but at a reduced price, that went directly against the whole idea of an unconditional retraction. He was basically trying to make a new deal, not going back to the one they had already agreed on. And the court pointed that out. They said his statements after the initial repudiation weren't, and I'm quoting here, a positive and unequivocal statement of his desire to once again abide by the contract. He wasn't unequivocally saying he was going to stick to the original deal.
Okay, so that makes sense. But what about that letter from his lawyer on August 30th, the one demanding the affidavit? Mm. That sounds like he was trying to move forward with the purchase, even if it was with that condition of getting the document. Did the court think that was him trying to retract his repudiation?
That's a good question. It might seem on the surface like he was trying to re-engage with the sale process, but the court saw it differently. They interpreted that demand for the affidavit as just another way to try and change the deal, to add a new condition. He wasn't truly retracting his earlier statement that he was out. Remember, he said he wasn't going to buy the farm before the closing date, August 1st. That's when Ratliff was supposed to give him the affidavit. The court's point was that a retraction has to be absolute. You can't use it as a tactic to force the other side to renegotiate or to add new terms to the original contract.
Ah, okay, I see. So the timing of everything is really important here. If Hardison hadn't already said he was out of the deal before the closing date, then maybe asking for the affidavit would have looked different. Might have been seen as him just making sure everything was in order before closing.
Exactly. But because he'd already repudiated the contract, that demand for the affidavit couldn't undo that. The court basically said that because Hardison backed out before August 1st, Ratliff didn't even have to give him the affidavit anymore. Hardison had already breached the contract. Asking for the affidavit afterward didn't magically fix that.
Okay, so let's bring it all back home. What are the big lessons that our listeners, especially those of you who are in law school or thinking about going to law school, what should you really take away from Ratliff v. Hardison? What does it tell us about anticipatory repudiation?
Well, first of all, it shows how important it is to be crystal clear when you're communicating about a contract. Yeah. If you're thinking about backing out, you can't just hint at it or make vague statements. If you want to legally repudiate a contract, you have to make it absolutely clear that you're not going to do what you agreed to do. No ambiguity, no room for misinterpretation. That's what positive and unequivocal manifestation means.
Makes sense. It's not enough to just be having doubts in your head. You have to clearly tell the other side that you're not going to follow through.
Right. Second, the case shows that if you do repudiate a contract and then you change your mind, you can't try to change the deal in the process. Your retraction has to be just as clear as the original repudiation, and you can't add any new conditions. You have to go back to the exact terms of the original agreement. No renegotiating allowed.
Got it. And lastly, I guess this case shows that if someone repudiates a contract, the other side doesn't have to just sit around and wait. They can take legal action right away if they want to.
That's a really important point for anyone who's going to be dealing with contracts. You don't have to just hope that the other party will come around if they've already made it clear they're not going to fulfill their end of the bargain.
So Ratliff v. Hardison, it really shows how important clear communication is in contracts and how serious the consequences can be if you say, you're not going to do what you promised. Once you say, I'm out, it's not always easy to get back in.
Definitely. And it brings up something interesting to think about, especially in today's world. You know, we do so much communicating through email, text messages, things like that. So how would this apply to, say, a text message where someone says they're not going to do what the contract says? Would that be considered a positive and unequivocal manifestation? And what would you have to do to retract that statement in a text? These are the kinds of questions that lawyers are grappling with more and more as technology changes how we communicate.
That's a really interesting point. It's like the law is catching up with how we live our lives now.
Exactly.
So, listeners, hopefully this deep dive into Ratliff v. Hardison has given you a better understanding of this whole idea of anticipatory repudiation. It's definitely something to keep in mind as you move forward in your legal careers. And who knows, maybe one of you will be arguing a case about anticipatory repudiation by text message someday.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Thanks for joining us on the deep dive. We'll see you next time.